listening to a session recorded at How Design Live, held June 22nd through the 26th, 2013, in San Francisco. Now to our session.
Welcome to day three of the Dialing Package Design Conference. We're almost to the end. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Ivan Navarro. I'm the Director of Events for thedialing.com. I had the pleasure of meeting a few of you last night at the event, so I'll see you guys later on today. I have the pleasure of introducing our first speaker of the day. She is the owner and founder of Knock Knock. Jen Billick has a background in book editing, writing, design, and arts and crafts. Knock Knock's witty, design-driven books and gifts, stationery, and products are sold in 6,000 stores across the United States and also have an extensive international distribution. Since launching Knock Knock in 2002, Jen has performed every role and made every mistake. Now she's lucky enough to write about it. So everyone, please welcome Jen Billick.
Thank you. Hi, how are you guys this morning? First presentation of the day. Wow, it's my first presentation of the day too. So let me just get a little oriented here. So I'm going to do something first that if you ever asked me about public speaking, I would tell you absolutely not to do, which is that I was really honored to be invited here to fill in somebody who wasn't able to come. So this presentation is just slightly last minute, so I hope you will bear with me on it. I didn't manage a handout, but maybe I'll do one later and it can email to you guys. And I would have loved on this topic to include products other than Knock Knocks, but I know Knock Knocks really well, so that's it. And really, I'm letting you guys into what our process has been versus what any books we haven't read would say. And so it'll be kind of a Knock Knock tour. And I do have to toot my own horn a little bit. I do PowerPoint rarely enough that I know it just a little bit, and I have to relearn it every time and discover once again it does not have a kerning function. So this is Knock Knock. These are actually our catalogs for retailers. And we, as you guys just heard, make witty gifts and stationery products and publish books. And the reason why I started Knock Knock, in part, was that I wanted to be able to write and design at the same time. I loved doing both equally, and the ability to integrate them and have them complement one another versus have them be two separate processes was very exciting to me. And so this is one of our first products, and there's no way that I could have created this without doing both at the same time. It was already really hard on a small screen in Quark with all those arrows. Then I discovered Illustrator. So I started out in publishing as a book editor, and one of the things that really struck me in my first editing job was that everybody's opinion on book covers mattered. You know, when I was 22 and just out of school, and my opinion mattered to almost nobody. But when it came time to decide on book covers, the editor would go all around the office to the accounting team. I mean, people who never had involvement in creative work, because they wanted somebody with clean eyes, somebody who hadn't yet seen the cover, and they wanted their immediate sort of cold read on it. So this is what I now think about with packaging in general, both with our own book covers, but with packaging. You know, you just want that immediate get. And, you know, sometimes maybe you'll show it to somebody who's a part of an audience that you hadn't intended it for, and their response isn't as relevant to you, but still, just having that immediate, you know, getting out of the little group of you working on it who have seen it in every iteration and going to somebody who's never seen it is really useful. So I happen to know that books, especially self-help books, if they have a number in the title, they do a lot better. And then also sex is a really good performer, which is a weird thing to say, so that's why I use the word seduction. So there are basically six stages where you have the opportunity to grab people with your product. And copy is obviously a big part of that. I'm going to be talking about copy a lot as a part of design, but also this applies to all design elements, especially the finer ones that are hard to see up close. So number one is entering the store, which we have absolutely no control over. which is nice. There's so many things that we do have control over and that are our fault if they go wrong. It's nice every once in a while to have something not be our problem. The only time we do have control over that is, you see in the upper corner there, that's the one time on my little Trio phone in 2006, before cameras were 3 megapixels on phones or 4 or 5, that I was able to see Knock Knock product take over an entire window, and it was really, really exciting. So then I suppose I could be blamed if they didn't come in. So people have to walk into the store, and then the product has to catch their eye from about 10 feet away, enough for them to make the decision to walk over to the product. And the product we're looking at right now is our book, The Complete Manual of Things That Might Kill You, A Guide to Self-Diagnosis for Hypochondriacs, which is required reading in some doctor's offices. And you see it in the middle of the screen there, and imagine yourself as a customer, a hypochondriac, but not so bad that this book is going to freak you out. And over you walk, and now you're about 18 inches away from it. And that is when the customer is maybe going to see the subtitle. You know, what we're looking at here is obviously kill you is the money shot. You know, you can see it from across the room. Why would something say kill you on it? You've got that intrigue. You can see things that might when you're a little bit closer, and then you've got the complete manual of, and the subtitle at the bottom. The figure in the middle just gives you a vague whiff of medicalism. And then there's all the diseases pointed out. So it's very much a staged perception of the copy on the cover or on the packaging. And then stage 4 is actually picking up the product. And that's when people, you're already partway to a conversion there. People are also feeling the heft or the weight, the texture of everything, looking at the front and the sides and the back. And then the holy grail, they turn it over to read the back. And one of the ways that I've formulated some of these dynamics in my head is working with the designers that we've hired over the years who may not come from a packaging design background. And what I find they often say when our response to a design is, that is so gorgeous, but it doesn't work at all, is they always say, oh, but when they walk over to it, pick it up and turn it over, they're going to understand what the product is. And we're like, well, yeah, but if they don't walk over and don't pick it up and turn it over, they'll have no idea, and the cover or the packaging doesn't really promote that. So, and then 6 is buying the product, which we also have no control over. So 1 in 6. Of course, we do our best, and we make products to be sold. We are so small that we don't do focus group testing, other than trying to find people in accounting who have never seen the product before. We're pretty nimble and changing all the time, and also always behind on our schedule. So we don't really get early reads, other than from some of our buyers and retailers. And retailers also, make misjudgments of what customers will want. We have numerous stories of retailers like Urban Outfitters buying a product in huge quantities that they really think is going to be a success, and then it just doesn't sell in versus sell through. I once had a consultant say to me, if you could just figure out what would sell before you manufactured it. And I was like, oh my God, are we paying you? That's, thank you. So, all of this is obviously incredibly easy with one exception, which is the 3-second rule. And when I first heard that, I thought it was this 3-second rule, which we actually debunk in the complete manual of things that might kill you. It doesn't matter how long or short it's on the floor, it gets the germs. But I'm pro-germ. I'm a big believer in resistance. But this is the 3-second rule, where the customer is going to decide whether or not to engage with your product in about 3 seconds, no matter that you put hundreds of hours into it. And this is my tragedy. This is the wishing kit. This is a product that was in our first release of product in 2002, and I just thought it was absolutely beautiful. I still do. It was everything that you need to throw a wishing party, which you guys have all heard of, right? A wishing party? You see wishing party and you think, I know what that is. And then on the inside of the lid, which actually you could see at point of purchase in the store, here were all of the explanations. Like, how could you go wrong on this? How could somebody not get it? And then this, the packaging, the thing that most customers saw. I loved the minimal. I was above taglines. I was above stickers. And we won an award, actually, from the company where we manufactured the box, Mason Box Company. It came in a flimsy piece of vinyl, and it was around the office. Like, we could not lose this thing. But this was where somebody who was more experienced in the product sales arena told me about the 3-second rule. And even though we'd like to say, oh, but if you explain it, it's this, or this is what I meant, if the immediate get isn't there, I mean, one of the things that I like about creating product for sale in the marketplace, I'm not there to explain it. And it really lives or dies based on whether it works with the customer. And you just have to accept the inevitable, including the fact that people don't read, which I'll talk more about later. But what we really want to do as packaging designers, and especially with copy, is guide the viewer's experience. So, of course, that has to do with things like hierarchy and, you know, where you draw the viewer's eye. And we need to determine for ourselves what is the most beneficial sequence for the viewer to be reading the copy that's on the product. And then, of course, we all want to get rich quick, even if we say we don't. So this is obviously not always easy because we have retailers who don't merchandise the way that we'd like. I'm always going into stores and moving our product around and straightening it up, and sometimes I get asked what I'm doing. Products are displayed in little tiny thumbnails online. This is particularly dynamic for publishing, where books were always at 100%, and now suddenly they're at 10%, and it's really changed cover design. Again, people who don't read, and even though I'm a big reader, and I think, well, I would read that, and I would get it, I find myself in stores doing the exact same thing that customers do, which is like, what? I don't get it, and I haven't read a thing. And then we find, especially with younger designers, they really want to design stuff with like 6-point type. And, you know, people who are older or who don't want to read small type, which now includes me because I started to do this with menus. And so that gives us some constraints. And then people who are just mean and they don't do what we want them to. So here are some environments in which we found Knock Knock product. We've got American Eagle at the upper left. You've got these noisy kind of settings. And then I love this somewhere in London, CR All Out of pad in the middle of like balloons and wrapping paper. But it does kind of stand out. And then we've got Blick Art Store. And then I just found this kind of endearing. It's a department store in Malaysia. And I love seeing the mannequins and the clothes back there. It just seems so incongruous to me. But you have no control over what environment you're in, whether you're on a table, spine out, et cetera. And like I said, people really, really, really don't read. Here's an example of something called our pocket notes. And they open like a matchbook. You can't quite see the... there's a texture difference. The yellow bar is a little taller than everything else because you pull the cover out. So we put this sticker on it that says opens like a matchbook. And still, like whenever I go into a store, I see these exact rips. So it doesn't matter what people should do. People just do what they do. And you can't fight inevitability. You just have to learn about the way people are going to perceive things. And in general, people don't want to know they're being guided. It's sort of like that Steve Jobs thing about how people don't know what they want. We have to show them what they want. So the way that we can achieve visual hierarchy and packaging copy, I know this is all pretty straightforward, but, you know, type size, both point size and weight, whether the copy is connected to the imagery or not connected to the imagery, if it's a caption, the image is more important, and the hierarchy of copy within the overall packaging design. Composition, people read left to right and top to bottom. And you want to get the appropriate compositional tension in there so it all kind of coheres. And then color, especially contrast. And then one of the things we struggle a lot with, we'd love to use gazillion different fonts and crazy fonts and display fonts and new fonts. But then we put them up and we hang them across the room, which is something that we're always having to remind ourselves to do. You know, we look at things so close up all the time, and we even look at them at like 300%. We're working on them on the computer so big, and it's so hard to remember to print it out at 100%, trim it, put it on the wall, take this, you know, step back to 10 feet. And I even squint my eyes a little bit, and if it's not still legible with me cross-eyed, then we sort of have to readdress it. Obviously, graphics like frames and pointers and backgrounds, and then things like debossing, spot varnish, etc. So here's an example. These are our Inner Truth journals, and they've been a total juggernaut for us. And obviously, very simple treatment. But I think there are certain things that work here to communicate. You've got the title of each journal, which is, and we have, I think, about 12 of them now. And the title is meant to be intriguing and kind of surprising. And then how do people know it's a journal versus a book? We call that out in color. And then as a design element, the copy is going from larger to smaller, and the smaller copy is not necessary to understand the product, but the way it kind of leads you by going larger to smaller is it engages you in the copy, and you really, like, it gives it a bit of a momentum that you want to read on, but in the first two or three lines is the explanation of what it is. These are our very important pens, VIPs. We had real challenges designing this. We weren't sure whether they should be horizontal or vertical in the box. You know, how can we show the pen but also explain what it is? I'm so happy with this particular solution. I think it came out really well. And this is a bit of an example of the less is more thing, where you know, you've got the, you want the most sort of controversial and exciting element to be the first foot forward. And then, you know, using some hyperbole, mightier than, you know, how is a pen mightier than? So that's kind of hyperbole, and you think, oh, that must be a very important pen. This is our personal library kit. It's the only product that's on our list that was on our 2002 debut of products, in the format on the left, with the wood box. And I just think it's interesting sort of the way that we then refreshed it in terms of what we'd learned about what people perceive on the package. The personal library kit phrase is front and center on both. We've got the call to action that says get your books back on both. But we learned with the second one we were able to make it a little bit more subtle. Partly because people already knew it in the marketplace to some extent, but also because we realized that the elements speak for themselves, and that actually sometimes the old version sold better when the belly band slid down and you could see the pockets in their entirety. We hire designers from all kinds of different backgrounds because we're really a blend. We're not industrial design, and we're not entirely just book or editorial design. So editorial designers, magazines, newspapers, book interiors, presuppose that the viewer is already at less than an arm's length away. So it presupposes a converted customer who's already picked up the thing. And what I have found with new editorial designers that we hire is they use really, really small type. And then you've got corporate marketing designers who do stuff with client services, and that also sort of presupposes a somewhat converted customer. I mean, you know, they're getting an annual report or a folder of some kind, and it's also often a specialized and narrow audience, so you're not designing quite as much for sort of brick-and-mortar visibility. Digital designers are now accustomed to changing context because you've got the computer versus the tablet versus the smartphone, but it still presupposes a close-up viewer. I think for us, advertising designers are the most accustomed to thinking of design and text hierarchies in a real-world environment. Is it on the side of the bus? Is it a postcard? Is it on a billboard? So as designers come into Knock Knock, one of the ways that we approach sort of orienting them to the way that we have found works is by thinking about where they come from and what the dynamics of what they were designing were, especially in terms of context, and then talking about the context for our products. This is one of our bestsellers from the spring season, What I Love About You by Me, and it's a fill-in book. So it's like you make a love letter for somebody. And we wanted to show that it was a fill-in, so we used the acetate jacket with the you and me looking like they're filled in by handwriting, and then the little burst at the upper left, you fill in the blanks. We had a lot of trouble getting to this cover and feeling like we were communicating what the product actually was. And these are some of the discarded designs, you know, that weren't fully fleshed out, but that we explored. And one of the main problems was legibility. So I love the font in the green cover, but, you know, it doesn't pass the squint test at all. You know, the thin lines go away and you really can't read it. And then we also felt that the copy, the type design and the copy didn't explain what the book was. And so, you know, getting to this from that was a pretty important sort of exploration of type hierarchy and communication for us. This is a line that did not do well for us, though it won a lot of design awards, and basically we have found that when things win design awards, they don't sell. But we're still really delighted with the awards. So these we called recovery kits. So birthday, workday, breakup recovery, hangover. And, you know, they had a number of little things in the box. Way too subtle. And we thought that the cross would be enough to indicate that it was something about, you know, getting better or health, and it totally was not. And we needed photography and didn't have that. So that was a big learning experience for us, that it was way too subtle. And basically the more complex the concept that you're trying to put forth, the more clear that you have to be. So some things that packaging copy needs to be, and then it obviously depends on how easy the get on the product is going to be. These are our self-inking stamps, which also won a lot of awards, but we were told by a lot of people in the field that they should have just been packaged in clear plastic so people could see the stamper itself. But I'm still very proud of the text hierarchy on this. Self-inking stamp is front and center. Look inside so that you can see the top. And the rest is really just design and Easter eggs. You know, you can't see that copy if you cross your eyes. And it's only if somebody picks it up and wants to be sort of rewarded by it. And we try to pack enough humor in there so that it's like, you know, it's like a treat for the person who goes, you know, to that next step. So I think about it, if a product is functional only, the copy either doesn't need to, you know, if it's obvious, doesn't need to be there, and it enhances and explains. If it's hard to understand, you really need to focus on the get. Novelty products, if it's an easy get, the copy is not critical because the product sort of speaks for itself. Novelty, but a difficult get, that's the hardest, and when you have to be in some ways the most simple. And then if it's completely self-explanatory, the copy is either unnecessary or can do its own thing. One example of that is the mail order razor guy. I can't remember what that company is called. So funny. You guys know what I'm talking about with the video? Dollar Shave Club. Thank you. Thank you. Once I start shaving my face, maybe I'll... No, but because I don't think they're so good for legs. You know, that's a case where the product is completely self-explanatory, so he wrapped it in a cushion, a fantasy, a world of marketing copy. I think it's so impressive. Here's another failure of ours. This was a kit. I love the failures. They're so much more interesting. Oh, you were laughing at the product, not the failure. I laugh at both. So this was like a kit, like all you needed with a bottle of wine to throw somebody a little party. We also had apology. We had a number of different titles. And we did it in illustration, and we called it fête-à-tête, which we thought was so witty. And the hierarchy is completely wrong. Happy birthday is the biggest. It doesn't explain what it is. Party for two. The idea of just add a bottle of wine was something we learned over time, and nobody got it. We actually had the opportunity to do a customized version for Pier 1. I think that we did not do a great job on the photography. Again, we didn't change the copy. So that's one case where both hierarchy and, you know, a complicated concept needing to be expressed much more simply, a call to action, just add wine, kind of thing. So we would often like to do things with our typography that's more interesting, but because the content and the concept are front and center, we can't have the typography competing with that. So we find ourselves often using a lot of sans serif, you know, very sort of basic type. So you always have to look at what's the hierarchy between the content and the imagery versus the type, and you know, have the two be in balance. This is an older product of ours, Wheels of Wisdom. Some of these designs being older, I look at them and I'm like, oh my God, we've come so far. What were we thinking then? But, you know, obviously the product itself is pretty complex and speaks for itself. And so the header didn't need to do a lot. Slang flashcards, I think, is a good example of, the major title being there, the aesthetic underscoring what we're doing with the humor. You know, there's this tension between the content and the format of this old kind of pedagogical tool. Explaining what the product does, having a really alluring tagline, and then you turn it over and there's all your, you know, clear stuff. We did the same thing with the sex flashcards. My favorite thing is warning contains sexual content there. And then with a lot of our product, actually the product itself is its own packaging. Rate That Wine, our pads and our sticky notes and our books are examples of that. I really believe in the importance of the Easter egg. For somebody who's willing to look really closely, they should get a reward. And the bottom tagline here is whether you spit or swallow, which sales is the only time I've used my major veto power to really overrule sales, because they thought this would sell into places that had more delicate sensibilities, but I just thought it was too good, so I kept it, and I thought people would enjoy the Easter egg. This is a new great seller for us, and I think it illustrates the balance that you need to strike between surprise and familiarity. There's a quote about novels that great endings should be surprising yet inevitable, and I feel that the balance between surprise and familiarity is a really important one. If it's too surprising, people don't get it. If it's too familiar, it's boring. So you see at the lower right, and that's another design exploration that we did, but I felt that what this product needed to do is convey guest book, guest book, guest book, and then the funny would be in the bathroom. So it's padded, it's that padded vinyl and stamped. So this was an example of how much surprise versus how much familiarity. This, as you can tell from this particular presentation, is my motto to live by. It's actually in our philosophy. But with packaging, it's actually the opposite. You want to use as few words as you possibly can to convey what you need to convey, except when the overabundance of words themselves, as on the self-inking stamps copy, is part of the design. So I think packaging copy, therefore, is a lot harder to write. I think the shorter anything is, the harder it is to write. And it's a little bit more like poetry, where each word counts. And this is an example of something where, for us, less definitely was more. The snow globe was pretty obvious and clear, and we were just wrapping it in a concept, which was instant happiness. And you could really see what was going on inside. Another very simple thing that actually took us quite a while to get to, this is a new release for us, boxes. And it started off kind of mundane, like savvy storage for your stuff. I mean, what's savvy storage? And we have a few words that we use way too often, handy, savvy, and stylish. So this one was a challenge of, we wanted it to be very classic knock-knock, and to not have very much content on it, because it's pretty clear what it is. And this is what we ultimately got to. Because it was so obvious, we decided to say, it is a box. So just one little tip at the end. I'm a big believer in spewing and brainstorming, that if you want to get the best idea, you can't just choose the first idea that comes to mind. You have to choose from among. So you have to generate for yourself, you know, enough ideas that you really know that the one that you go with is something that you've chosen from among, and it's really better than all of the others that you've come up with, or it works better. And, I think think that all creativity has this general sweep. You know, people always think the inspiration and perspiration breakdown is the opposite of what it is. And it's the same thing with concepting and brainstorming. With writing and concepting and brainstorming, I think of it as creating the marble out of which you will sculpt your finished piece. So you concept and you brainstorm on which direction you want to take, and then you just spew, you know, just like anything that comes to mind. You're free writing. You're like, you know, just your mouth is just running, sort of like mine is right now. And then after that, you take it upon yourself to edit or sculpt. And then and only then do you focus on composing the sentences or the words themselves, because why focus on finessing if you're just going to cut it? And then ultimately you finesse and you make it all work. But this workflow makes a lot of sense for me in a lot of the things that we do. And that is that. That is us. I don't know if we have time for any questions, but if we do, I'd love to take them. And thank you so much. Oh, we have 10 minutes. Oh, my God. It says 47 here. Did you hear me hurrying up? You know, because I had the 40. Man, I sped. Okay. Questions. I can also ask myself questions. Oh, I see a hand. Yes. That's a really good question. I would say we probably spend about 10% of our time in active, creative creation. Of that, brainstorming is probably, I would say we probably spend 2 or 3% of our overall time in brainstorming. It's obviously a really important part of the time, but I have really found over and over again that execution is kind of 9/10 of the creation, but obviously each tenth isn't equally weighted. And the brainstorming, the time that we spend with other people bouncing ideas off of each other and allowing things to just kind of come up, especially when it comes to taglines and product names, is really, really key. We're usually in there. I have a favorite thesaurus called the Synonym Finder, because all other thesauruses kind of suck. And so when we're brainstorming, especially on copy and stuff, we have that. It's like a thesaurus for people who already have big vocabularies, and you just need to be prompted on. But you don't need to have a big vocabulary.
Hi, Jen. First of all, I love Knock Knock.
Jose and I are friends.
Yes.
But not just because he loves Knock Knock.
And this is a question relative to what I'm doing and also something you said. You said that you can't really predict the future, whether something's going to be, you know, a hit or not, really, because the retail channels might not even let you, you know, show something before it's done. They want to buy it and ready to go. Have you found, are there ways to develop a product that gets tested, let's say, online, even though it's going to eventually be a physical product, and get response from a larger audience? Have you attempted that?
Well, unlike that particular consultant, you have a crystal ball. Because we're just starting to do some of that. Our challenge has been twofold. One, we are always behind in terms of schedule, in terms of our two annual seasonal releases a year. So having a product that is well-developed enough for a non, you know, insider industry designer person to understand, sort of like why some people can't buy fixer-upper houses. They just can't see, you know, that you could slap some paint up and, you know, put in some wood floors and it would be great. It's the same thing with testing product. It has to be far enough along for people to really get it. So that's been a big challenge for us. We're trying to do a few things now that we're really hoping are great learning experiences for us. One is we are finally ahead enough of the curve. Like, we've gained a week a year on each season. That we're going to start doing online focus groups with what we're just internally calling super customers. You know, people who we know would be willing to put in some of their time and opinions in exchange for some free product, and you know, and give us opinions on the new products that we're releasing before we manufacture them. You know, obviously there are two big investments in product. There's the development time internally, and our stuff is pretty labor intensive, even though sometimes it doesn't look like it. To get it to be simple and right. And then, two, there's the manufacturing expense and inventory expense. So obviously we wouldn't be able to eliminate the first in a case of a product that didn't seem to be successful, but we would eliminate the second. The other thing that we're going to start doing is test runs of things that we can do in very short runs, which does not include things that are offset printed, on some flash sale sites that we're friends with. So one example is we want to try doing pillows. And pillows you can have sewn, you know, to order, you know, by a sewing shop. And so we can just do the mock-ups, have them pictured, have them on the flash sale, see if there's interest, manufacture exactly to order, and then see if it's something we want to bring into our line. We're also going to try some experimenting with sites like Cafe Press, really purely to see, do people really want T-shirts with some of our stuff on them and so forth. Less as a revenue center and more as a place to experiment.
So experimentation, and I apologize for hugging the mic, but just one last question. I spoke to a young lady yesterday who wants to start a business just like yours. If you're a designer or packaging designer and you want to do it, and this is a business question, any tips or any kind of mistakes you made that you can prevent her from making? And that's my last question. So anybody else want to?
There are a lot of them. And I've written about them pretty extensively, actually. And I just started a blog with Ink called Hard Knocks about all the ways in which I've completely messed up, which are so legion. And then for our 10-year anniversary, I did a year-by-year blog post thing that basically is just a compendium of our mistakes. So there's plenty of them. I think the biggest thing is that the business model for an inventory-based product business is very different from the business model for client services design. So really understanding the cash flow differently and how hard it is financially to have inventory, you know, because the gap between when you pay for something and when you get paid for it is so big. It's called the capital cycle, by the way. I learned in a class. But hi.
You're leading into my question in terms of, can you talk a little bit about the pluses and minuses of, to some degree, being your own client?
Good question. One of my, it's attached to my lanyard, by the way, which I think is, you know, kind of cool. But one of the things that drove me when I started Knock Knock is I wanted to not have clients. Like, that was a specific goal. And I know there can be really great clients, you know, who, like, urge you to do the best you've ever done, and they're like collaborators. But I also hear that those are kind of few and far between. And my goal was that I wanted us to get things to where we thought they were really great and finished and let them live or die in the marketplace. And I still much prefer that. I don't like other people's opinions if they're stupid. you know, I sort of wanted Knock Knock to be a little bit like a think tank in that, you know, I would get to pick my team, and now, of course, other people are picking the team. And, you know, because I hated those class projects where you have to collaborate with idiots. And but it's a lot better when you get to pick your own team, and that we would really be doing what we thought was great and we loved. We were, you know, sort of fancied ourselves to be smart and interesting and talented, and we would get things to where we thought they needed to be. The challenge with that is you can get pretty insular. And, you know, there are all the challenges of being an in-house brand. Like, we would love to do some pretty floral stuff. We would love to. I mean, we have so many among us. We have so many different aesthetics, and the brand can start to be a little bit confining. And we've tried to expand it in various ways, both within Knock Knock, its signature product itself, and then also by doing new lines of product under new names. And we haven't been as successful as we would like with that. And then, you know, it's also just, you know, remembering to go outside of the group for opinions and feedback and, you know, really looking up from your computer, looking out into the real world, store visits and so forth. But I would say I would not change it. I think, you know, client services, you get a lot more, I think, diversity of projects in some ways, and each one is sort of a new research undertaking. But it's really, I find the unity and togetherness we feel and then the pride in creating the product is something that I really like. Over there to the left. Oh, bilingual. Oh, Quebec. Can you just secede already? Nobody wants you. So I don't know, some of you may not know that all products sold in Canada has to have the critical copy in both French and English, as if the Québécois cannot read English. And it was basically just a concession so they wouldn't secede, and I don't see why they don't just let them. I sort of feel the same way about Texas, but you didn't hear me say that. So they can have their own textbooks with, you know, okay, I'm going to start offending people. So there's two things with bilingual copy. If you have to do it all the way through, that's a total pain in the butt, and it's a major design challenge. With the, just translating, the 50 sheets of feuille is sheets, and it also actually, it's the same as a very kind of gross word that I won't say in French. I know both page counts and swear words in French. So we really just try to minimize that and have it, it's basically like the ingredients. You try and make it sort of as small and unobtrusive as possible. If you would have to do, I would say, a bigger scale bilingual, like it really truly had to be bilingual, my instinct is always to celebrate that rather than to hide it, to let the bones show. Sort of have the bilingual language play off of each other. It's hard when you don't have that much real estate on a package. But my instinct, when we haven't had to do this, we either have translations or we have English with the little French things. But my instinct would be to have fun with it, play it up, and have it be a part of the design and the concept of the packaging. But that's just, I would say that's just an opinion. And if everything you do has to be completely bilingual, I really feel for you. Has it? Which language are you contending with and where? Oh, I'm sorry. I hope you're not from Quebec. Okay. Yeah, no, it's tough, and I really think it's unfair, and, French is no longer the lingua franca, which is, of course, an irony unto itself. Thank you. Thank you, guys. This is really fun. Okay, bye.
Thank you for listening. This concludes our session. For information regarding other sessions in the series, please go to our website at www.aven.com.